We're in Luke 16, and the theme is this: are we using our wealth to serve God or ourselves? In the first part of the chapter, we have this dishonest manager who is praised for being shrewd in his dealings, and the encouragement is that we need to be shrewd as well so we can make friends with God by use of our money. In the second half of the chapter, we have this rich man who used his wealth only for himself, did not make friends with God, and he found his fortunes reversed in the end. But this initial parable is odd, Morgan. We have a master who fires his servant because he's mismanaged his finances, and then Jesus later praises him for even further dishonesty. What's going on here?
Yeah, so we got this servant, and he is wasteful. It's actually the same word that describes the prodigal son's living in chapter 15, verse 13. Some have tried to rescue the character of the steward by saying that he's going to his master's debtors and only erasing his commission or maybe the master's unlawful interest. But we really need to take care to notice that the word dishonest that we read should be translated, as it is in some English translations, as unrighteous. This is not a good guy. What he's doing is he has recklessly spent his master's funds, and now he's continuing to defraud his master, canceling out debts that belong to people rightfully, in hope that the debtors are going to owe him a favor down the road. And so the only person he's looking out for is himself.
So why is he praised for us?
So Jesus specifically says that he's praised for his shrewdness. It's the same way that we despise a thief, but man, we love a good heist movie. And right. There are plenty of biblical characters that demonstrate that same kind of shrewdness. I mean, think about Rahab when she lied about the Jewish spies. She was shrewd, but she's praised for that action. We also see it in Rebecca, who helps Jacob get the blessing that belonged to his elder brother Esau. And she's being shrewd, but she's also doing what God told her would happen back when she was pregnant with the two boys.
So how does Jesus expect us then to model this unrighteous person?
So the point is that the sons of this world, the unrighteous, they know how to use money to their advantage. And we should be just as shrewd in using our money to make friends with God. So just as the steward was desperate to use his influence to make friends with the world, how much more should we be willing to use whatever we have to enter into the kingdom of heaven?
So then if we're not using our money for God, Jesus is teaching here that it's become our master.
And that's what makes verses 14 through 15 sting, right? The Pharisees, we're told, are lovers of money, and they're sneering at Jesus about this teaching. And Jesus says that anything that we hold up, like the Pharisees did with their money, he calls that an abomination. And that's a word in the Old Testament used to describe the idols of Israel's enemies. Interesting wordplay as well. Abomination comes from the idea of something that stinks so much that it repulses you. So while the Pharisees are sneering, wrinkling their nose at Jesus, God is wrinkling his nose in disgust at them. And if money is our master, God has the same reaction.
So verses 1 to 15 are clearly about money, and verses 19 to 31 really hit on money as well. How does Jesus's teaching in the middle of the chapter about the validity of the law and how it's all going to be brought into judgment, and Jesus teaching about divorce, how is this going to enter this context of money?
So this could be part of a larger critique of the Pharisees. So there are three issues at play here. Jesus is obviously talking about greed, but then he's also wanting us to honor the law and the prophets to see their validity, and also to have the proper perspective on divorce and remarriage. These were three big issues that a group called the Essenes had against the Pharisees. We don't read about the Essenes in our Bibles at all, but they were a group that kind of lived apart from society at large during the days of Jesus. They're the ones who actually wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. And in those scrolls, they said that the sins of the Pharisees were fornication, greed, and speaking against the law of God. And it's fascinating because Paul actually cites those same three concerns in Romans chapter 2, 21 through 23. So Jesus might be including these to show that the Pharisees' unfaithfulness towards God in matters of money had grown into something much more sinister. It had turned them against God in all of these other matters as well.
So it's really just like what we saw in verse 13. If you serve one master, you're going to end up hating the other. The Pharisees, they love money. That has become their master, and they don't really realize it. But when Jesus has come, they are sneering at him. And what they don't realize is they're sneering at God's son. The saying really is true. Their love of money has caused them to hate God.
So to reinforce this point about money, we move then into the final parable, the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And I call it a parable, but a lot of people don't. So Scott, is this a parable or is it a real picture of the afterlife? And doesn't even matter?
Right. So from one perspective, it's told in the context of other parables. And if you take this literally, like very literally, then there are some things here that are strange. I mean, certainly I'm okay with God doing things in his own way, and I want to totally jive with however God does things. But, you know, some questions I would have if this is intended to be reality is, well, do we expect in the afterlife to be able to have front row tickets to those who are being tortured in Hades?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there a physical chasm between the two? Do we expect to all be rocked in the arms of Abraham? Again, maybe I'm just missing things. On the other hand, I do see that, I mean, Lazarus is named. So I get that some would see this as a real picture of the afterlife. As I told you earlier, I just don't really have a take because ultimately, kind of like your question implies, maybe it really doesn't matter so much because, I mean, maybe this is not the place that we're going to come regardless to find really, really solid, unchangeable truths about exactly precisely what the afterlife is going to be like. We do find some general descriptions. It's irreversible. It's based on the work of the individual in their life in this world. And we do see the two sides. You're either going to be in comfort or you're going to be in torment. And I like just kind of leaving learning about the afterlife at just really that from this story or parable or however you want to take it.
Okay, so parable or not, tell us about the rich man.
Yeah, so he's super rich. He wore purple, which was what rich people wore in that day. He dined sumptuously at his table every day. But you'll notice that Lazarus was there each day, longing to be able to be fed with the scraps, but he doesn't get any of it. Lazarus, he recognizes in the afterlife, and the rich man would have seen him then day by day, but he doesn't share any of it with him. Wouldn't do anything to help poor Lazarus.
So speaking of Lazarus, he's the only story character that's ever really named by Jesus, parable or not. Is that important?
So I like to think about it like this. We know exactly who the rich and famous are in our day, and we don't really know who the poor are. And yet Jesus has reversed this in the parable. The poor man who never gets anything, who you would think is totally forgotten, well, guess what? He has a name, and he shares in the good afterlife, the comfort in the afterlife. But the rich, who you would expect, hey, like everybody knows who he is, he doesn't have a name. And he's been humiliated. It's just like what Jesus talked about earlier in the Sermon on the Plain. There's this reversal of fortunes that is coming one day. And as far as Lazarus is concerned, well, he's living a rough life, right? He's just desperate for the crumbs of the rich man. He's got open wounds that are being licked by the dogs. Maybe you could see it as like the only companions of Lazarus, this poor man, are unclean animals, and they're going ahead and getting a taste of him before he even dies.
So they both die, and of course, that's when everything changes.
Yeah, it's a foretaste of the great reversal that is going to come through Jesus's kingdom, and now they're starting to get that in the afterlife. Lazarus, carried by angels to Abraham's side to comfort, rich man, dead, buried. That's all he has in the afterlife, and torment.
So should I expect to be in torment because I have money? Should I expect to automatically go to heaven because I'm poor? That is, does God already have these categories in mind of who's saved and not, just based on money?
Right. This is something that we talked about earlier with the Sermon on the Plain. And again, the important thing is, who are we How do we use that money? There's rich people throughout the scriptures who are righteous. There's rich people throughout the scriptures who are evil, and even poor who they are not faithful, and poor who are faithful. So it just really depends on who are we. So the point of the previous parable told us and really asked us, how do you use your money? Do you use your money to make friends with God and his people? And the rich man, he only used his money for himself while he ignored the poor. And in the afterlife, the rich man is able to finally reflect. He sees Lazarus. And now that he needs something from him, he wishes, man, I wish I would have given something in life on earth, but he's not going to be able to receive anything because he gave nothing in his earthly life. And I think there's an interesting point to be made here. Then you'll notice with the rich man that he's not spoken of as actively doing wicked actions in his life. Rather, he was neglectful. He didn't do the good things that God intended him to do. He had been entrusted with great wealth from God, but he didn't make a friend of God or of God's people or of Lazarus with his wealth. And now he's not being received into eternal dwellings. And his ultimate wish here is, okay, if I can't get any comfort, then please save my brothers. I want to warn them in some sort of way that so that they can avoid this place. Just send Lazarus back over there. I know it's done for me, but send Lazarus back. And really, it seems that what he wants is more than the law and the prophets that have testified to him and testified to his brothers of what they need to be doing. And in that really is a subtle critique of God. God, you haven't given us enough to help us be saved and to avoid this sort of place. He wants more than God's revelation. But Jesus says, listen, the law and the prophets, Moses and the prophets, they just need to hear them. That's enough. And he thinks, well, no, like we need a resurrection from the dead. If someone goes to them from the dead, then they will believe. But that's what's ironic is Jesus will be raised from the dead, and later on, they will not believe. And even on the road to Emmaus, after Jesus is resurrected, you'll notice that, yes, the resurrection is an important thing that will help people believe, but he goes back to what? The law and the prophets. That is enough to bring out belief.
And I think that's the big takeaway from the entire chapter. Jesus has given us enough. And we can come up with excuses and rationalize away his commands, turn deaf ears and blind eyes to our neighbor, but it's all going to catch up to us one day. So we need to take the time now to use our wealth to make friends with God and with our neighbor.